Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code Obscura. Forget one-size-fit-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listener, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. So head to Mood.com, find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off on your first order. Listener, summer nights are heating up, and if your mattress is trapping heat, it might be time for a change. Avocado Green Mattresses use breathable, organic materials that sleep cooler naturally. All avocado mattresses are crafted with certified organic latex, wool, and cotton. Breathable materials that sleep cooler and are free from harmful chemicals. Destined to provide exceptional comfort and support with options ranging from gentle, firm to plush, meeting diverse sleep needs and preferences. Take our mattress quiz to see which mattress and comfort option is right for you. And it promotes better sleep through breathable, naturally temperature regulating materials, which can improve overall well-being. No harmful chemicals, just healthy materials for a cleaner, safer sleep. Avocado is committed to sustainability. Every avocado mattress is made from eco-friendly materials and built to last. High quality means fewer replacements, better for the planet and your wallet. And avocado mattresses are ethical and transparent. From sourcing to production, Avocado holds itself to the highest sustainability and safety standards. Certified organic and always honest. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today and check out their mattress and bedding sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Listener, we're all familiar with the oxymoron that silence is deafening. I'm sure you know what that sounds like. An awkward silence in a room full of people. A silence so intense, you can hear your heart pounding. If you've ever experienced snowfall in the wilderness, it's probably struck you that not only can you not hear a sound, but you've likely contemplated the more unsettling thought that if you screamed, no one would be able to hear you. When you can hear the snowflakes falling in the middle of nowhere, and there's no animals or people in sight for miles around, you could feel like the only person on Earth. Most of us are familiar with reality TV shows where people are isolated in remote locations around the world to test and demonstrate their skills. Extreme temperatures, exposure, hunger, dehydration, and exhaustion, not to mention threats from native wildlife, all pose additional complications. It's difficult to imagine how we'd cope with such a grueling test of our mental and physical limits. Even when the most experienced of survivalists are navigating challenging terrain, using unusual methods of sourcing food and water, and only their smarts to extricate themselves from difficult situations, it's easy for us to be reassured and entertained. On TV, people are usually equipped with protective clothing, tools, and all five of their senses to help them get to where they need to go. We generally know that at the conclusion of each episode, people are generally not at too great a level of personal risk, and in an emergency, are always within easy reach of being transported by rescue helicopter should they require emergency assistance. And sure, we might scoff at some elements of the escape plan and say we might do things differently, but it's easy to do so from the comfort of our couch. There's one additional challenge we don't often see survivalists or contestants on TV overcoming in their battle against the elements, and that's fear. The people we see have no reason to fear death from exposure, starvation, sudden changes in weather, dehydration. Feeling scared and highly anxious in survival situations is obviously a completely expected human reaction, but it also compromises our ability to solve problems and think clearly when we're racing against the clock. What helps people find their way to safety is not fearlessness, and it's not because we wouldn't ordinarily fear certain things if some part of the situation was different. What increases the chance of survival is that the people we watch in these orchestrated scenarios are not running from anyone. On most shows, people certainly have no reason to fear death at the hands of any person they encounter during their travels. But listener, what happens when you're stranded and don't have the experience and those survival skills? No idea how far away you are from the closest town. No way of knowing when or if you'll be rescued. To make things even more sinister, what if you'd been stripped naked, handcuffed and blindfolded? And listener, what if, stranded in the middle of nowhere, the movement of the person you could suddenly hear as they made their way through the trees towards you belonged to someone who wasn't coming to help you, but to hunt you? In the late 1960s, the city of Anchorage in South Central Alaska was by no means as cosmopolitan or populous as other major cities across the country. Despite the South Central region being home to over half of Alaska's population, the state is completely geographically isolated from the 48 mainland states of America, making Anchorage more of a sleepy frontier town. When abundant oil and gas reserves were discovered in 1957 at the Swanson River, on the Kenai Peninsula in southern Alaska, and later in 1968 at the Prudhoe Bay in the North Slope region of the state. At the time, there was no immediate need for these natural resources, but in 1973, the United States was plunged into the oil crisis thanks to the skyrocketing price of what became a valuable commodity. A method of delivering the available oil in Alaska to the lower 48 states would need to be swiftly remedied. This came with the construction of the 800-mile Trans-Alaskan Oil Pipeline, which commenced in 1973. The population of Alaska's largest city boomed as construction workers flooded into the area. A total of 28,000 people converged on the state to work in the construction industry alone and in Anchorage. The employment rate dropped to nearly zero. By the time the pipeline was completed in 1977, it could pump 2.1 million barrels of crude oil per day, the most of any crude oil pipeline in the U.S. Along with the construction came an unprecedented amount of disposable income to be spent in Anchorage. In addition to new legitimate businesses opening up, there was an influx of sex workers, dancers, pimps, and drug dealers into the red light Tenderloin district. Strip clubs and bars popped up overnight on 4th Avenue, which became known colloquially as the largest bar in the world. Young women, lured by a quick buck, flocked to Anchorage to work as exotic dancers in clubs like Wild Cherry, The Embers, The Red Garter, Good Times Lounge, Kit Kat Club, Arctic Fox, The Nevada Club, and the Great Alaskan Bush Company, where they can earn up to $500 a day. Talent agents and booking agencies scouring to hire exotic dancers and sex workers would cycle girls out on a well-known route from California, north to Portland, then on to Seattle, Honolulu, and Alaska. Many of the exotic dancers and sex workers who drifted into and out of town had issues with drug and alcohol dependency, so it wasn't unusual when some of these women seemed to leave town as quickly as they arrived. For pimps and owners of the clubs, employees overdosing or skipping town without notice to get clean or avoid paying a drug debt came with the territory. The population boom had a downside, though.
and the demand this placed on local law enforcement agencies soon outweighed their capacity to adequately deal with the escalation of violent crime, including assaults, firearm offenses, armed robberies, and murders. The city of Anchorage itself was patrolled by the Anchorage Police Department, or APD. The Alaska State Troopers were a smaller agency, but their jurisdiction were areas both just outside the city limits of Anchorage, as well as the rest of the entire state of Alaska. Prior to the 1970s, there hadn't been any identified need for the state troopers to have specific protocols for dealing with the cases of sexual assault, and any forensic evidence that needed to be processed had to be sent outside of Alaska. This would soon prove problematic when it came to adequately investigating the increase in the rate of sexual violence against women. On July 21, 1980, workers conducting electrical maintenance on Iglutna Lake Road outside Anchorage discovered a shallow grave containing badly decomposed human remains that had been partially consumed by animals. The body was that of a Caucasian brunette woman, estimated to be aged between 16 to 25 years old, who was wearing knee-high, reddish-brown, high-heeled boots, jeans, a sleeveless knit top, and a brown leather jacket. She was also wearing a silver cuff bracelet with polished stones, which appeared handmade. Very little other evidence was located at the scene, and law enforcement struggled to identify the young woman, who had clearly met a brutal and lonely end. When an identification failed to be made in the days following the discovery, police named their Jane Doe after the road where she was found. She became known as Iglutna Annie. That same month, the badly decomposed and partially frozen remains of another woman were found in a gravel pit near the Kenai Lake, just south of Moose Pass. When law enforcement arrived at the scene, the remains were being eaten by a bear, which eventually had to be shot by troopers to gain access to the site and preserve evidence. The body was identified as that of 24-year-old Joanna Messina, who disappeared on May 19, 1980, and was also known as Joanna McCoy. Joanna was a married dental assistant, but left her husband in New York and headed to Alaska with her German Shepherd. Arriving across the other side of the country, Joanna had hoped to find work in a cannery, but soon started working as an exotic dancer. She lived in a rooming house in Seward, owned by a local vet and his wife, and spent most of her time in her room reading. But it wasn't long before Joanna was evicted, so she moved into another rooming house run by a local woman. It was while living at this rooming house that Joanna disappeared, and her landlady reported her missing, also telling police that Joanna had been having an affair with the same vet she'd rented a room from previously. There were several suspects in Joanna's death. The first was the vet. Based on the allegations around the affair, when interviewed by state troopers, the vet denied knowing Joanna, but when a polygraph test revealed the vet was being deceptive, he finally admitted to having a relationship with Joanna. Other residents of the rooming house where Joanna lived reported that she hadn't exactly made friends with her fellow boarders due to her own behavior and that of her dog. Joanna also had a fractious relationship with the rooming house manager who'd reported her missing and who also reportedly kept a cache of guns, but she too was eventually eliminated. On September 12, 1982, two off-duty state troopers were out hunting moose along the Kinnick River, 25 miles outside Anchorage, when they noticed a boot sticking out of a gravel sandbar. Upon closer inspection, the pair also realized that a partially decomposed bone joint was also protruding from the ground. As trained law enforcement officers, both men retreated from the scene, leaving it undisturbed, and reported the grisly discovery to their senior colleagues. When investigators attended the scene the following day, they noted the area was only accessible by motor vehicle, riverboat, or small aircraft. After painstakingly sifting through the sand, a single shell casing from a .223 caliber bullet was found in the grave, the kind of ammunition used in high-powered rifles such as M16s, Mini-14s, or AR-15s. The body was that of a woman in her early 20s, who was barefoot but wearing blue jeans, a baby blue sky jacket with dark blue trim on the shoulders, a sweater, underwear, and a bra. The lack of bullet holes in the victim's clothing indicated she had been naked when shot, and then redressed after she was killed. An ace-elastic bandage had been wrapped around her head and face from forehead to nose, and was secured with metal clips. The victim was identified as 23-year-old exotic dancer Sherry Morrow, who was also known as Sherry Graves. Sherry worked at the Wild Cherry Bar as a waitress and exotic dancer, where she danced under the name of Georgia. Her boyfriend reported her missing on November 23rd, 1981, 6 days after he last saw her. Sherry was found in the clothes she was reported to be wearing when she disappeared, but a gold arrowhead-shaped pendant she wore that was a gift from her boyfriend was missing. An autopsy found pieces of copper-jacketed bullet fragments in Sherry's chest cavity. She had been dead for around 6 months, and 3 gunshot wounds in her back from 223 caliber bullets from a Ruger Mini 14 rifle were identified as the cause of death. Police re-interviewed Sherry's boyfriend, who stated he hadn't seen her since he dropped her off to work on East 4th Avenue at approximately 11:30 p.m. on November 16th. After her shift, Sherry stayed the night with a girlfriend and planned to attend a doctor's appointment the following day. Her boyfriend checked with Sherry's doctor, who said Sherry did not attend her appointment. Both Sherry's boyfriend and her girlfriend told police that Sherry had also planned to meet up with a man on November 17th at Ellis's 210 restaurant, who would pay her $300 for a photo shoot. Investigators told the Anchorage Daily News that they doubted the grisly discovery was related to the disappearance of at least 2 other women in the area in recent years, publicly denying any connection. As the months passed following Sherry's murder and no more bodies surfaced, police openly rejected the idea of a serial killer, treating Sherry's murder as an isolated event. But the book, Butcher Baker, The True Account of an Alaskan Serial Killer, by Walter Gilmore and Leland Hale, explains how behind closed doors, the discovery of Sherry Morrow's body actually gave police their first significant break in what was becoming a concerning pattern of disappearances. Someone was targeting the young women of Anchorage. Police just didn't know who. Listener, to find out how this started, what happened next, we first need to go back in time and over 3,000 miles away to the Midwestern state of Iowa. Robert Christian Hansen was born on February 15, 1939, in Estherville, in the Midwestern state of Iowa. His parents were Christian Hansen, a Danish immigrant and baker by trade, and his wife, Edna. The Hansen family later moved to California, but returned to Iowa after 7 years, moving to Pocahontas, where Christian purchased a bakery. Robert's father was exceptionally strict and very demanding. Despite Robert making every effort to please his father, Christian was a harsh disciplinarian and always found a fault with Robert, often referring to him as worthless. When Robert showed a tendency to be left-handed, Christian forced him instead to use his right hand. This was believed to have caused Robert such psychological stress as a child that he developed a debilitating stutter. Robert didn't exactly have an ally in his mother, Edna, who was known as a diminutive woman who always deferred to her overbearing husband and didn't make waves. Throughout childhood and adolescence, Robert was described as being quiet and a loner who had difficulty making friends. As well as being of slight build, Robert wore glasses and had acne so bad that he almost never socialized. Unsurprisingly, Robert was relentlessly bullied at school and straight out rejected by girls who refused to go out with him. During Robert's high school years, he worked part-time, but long hours in the family's bakery, often starting work at 2 a.m. on school days. His strict religious parents and a lack of extra money prevented him from participating in the same type of social activities as his peers. During high school, he played basketball and achieved letters in track for long-distance running and broad jump. But like many shy and socially awkward adolescents who are isolated from their peers, Robert preferred to keep to himself, finding solace in hunting, fishing, and archery. In 1957, following his high school graduation, 18-year-old Robert enlisted in the Army Reserves, completing his basic training at Fort Dix in New Jersey. During his training, he was awarded Soldier of the Week and received a weekend pass, which he used to take a trip to New York with another soldier to see the sights of the Big Apple. Robert lost his virginity to a sex worker in an unsatisfying encounter. He continued to serve for a year in the Army Reserve before being discharged. Robert went on to receive training as a military police officer in Fort Knox, Kentucky. Despite his bad experience in New York, he continued to visit sex workers in Fort Knox. By 1959, he returned to Pocahontas to work in his father's bakery, while also working as a junior police drill instructor for the Pocahontas Police Academy. Robert liked to shock and impress his co-workers at the bakery by shooting at targets in the shop after hours with a bow and arrow and throwing knives into the wall, both without making a sound. In the summer of 1960, Robert married a girl called Phoebe, who was the daughter of the local chiropractor. Less than 6 months later, on December 7, 1960, Robert and an accomplice set fire to the Pocahontas Community School Bus Barn by splashing around gasoline and setting it alight. Robert claimed he wanted to see if he'd get away with the fire and said he held a grudge against the school superintendent. Robert was aided by a 16-year-old co-worker from the bakery, whose conscience soon got the better of him, and he reported the fire to the police. When Robert's domineering father found out his son had been charged with arson, he was rightfully outraged. Robert, who attended the scene of the fire in his capacity as a volunteer fireman, pled guilty and was jailed for 3 years, but paroled after only serving 20 months of his sentence. Robert told the prison psychiatrist he lit the fire because he wanted to get even with everyone in Pocahontas. He spoke of his seething resentment for school and embarrassment about the bullying he received as a result of his stutter and severe acne. Despite the psychiatrist assessing Robert as having an infantile personality, during the incarceration, he did help inmates who couldn't read or write, and he also received some speech therapy for his stutter, which seemed to help slightly. Meanwhile, wedded bliss for Robert proved to be short-lived. Phoebe had initially believed that her new husband was innocent of any wrongdoings regarding the fire at the bus barn, but when she found out he'd lied about his involvement, she divorced him, despite only being married for 6 months. When Robert was paroled in May 1963, at age 24, he joined his parents in Leech Lake, Minnesota, where they'd moved from Iowa while he was imprisoned. Robert spent his days painting boats and cabins and pursued his passion for the outdoors. It was in Minnesota that Robert met his second wife, Darla Hendrickson, whom he married in the fall of 1963. The marriage wouldn't always be a happy one, with Robert prone to unpredictable outbursts of anger for no apparent reason. While Darla was finishing college, Robert took up work in bakeries in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, but he was far from being on the straight and narrow. By this stage, Robert had taken to stealing and was caught shoplifting at a sports store in 1965. His wife Darla sought help from their local pastor to vouch for her husband, and luckily for Robert, the charges were dropped. Over the next few years, Robert continued to drift from one job to the next, his frequent changes in employment punctuated by arrests for petty theft.
Listener, there seems to be fees everywhere these days, on anything from concert tickets to cleaning fees. They're everywhere, and they hurt the most when you're down. That's why Chime offers fee-free banking, which means no monthly fees, no overdraft fees, and no minimum balance fees. Sign up today at chime.com/obscura. Now, when I first moved back to Florida, I was desperately scrambling for a new bank, but so many of them had built-in fees. It took me a long time to find one that sat right with me. Fees can be a hurdle to getting ahead or saving up. With Chime, there's no monthly fees, no overdraft fees, no minimum balance requirements. Work on your financial goals through Chime today. Open an account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime. Feels like progress.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Timing depends on submission of payment file. Fees apply at out-of-network ATMs. Bank ranking and number of ATMs according to U.S. News and World Report 2023. Chime checking account required.
Listener, HomeAglow is a top-rated home service platform dedicated to making your space clean and tidy. It has online booking capabilities that allow you to instantly schedule a cleaner in your area for a special occasion, party, or to help take something off your plate. Cleaners pass a rigorous certification process. Plus, they maintain a 4.8 star average platform rating. A fantastic way to support cleaners in your community. 100% of the cleaning fees and tips go directly to your cleaner. To schedule a cleaner, you simply have to go to HomeAglow's website to choose the day and time you're looking for and the duration of your cleaning to match with the cleaner. Schedule as quickly as this week or get something on the calendar for next month to check it off your to-do list early. You can see photos and reviews of background check cleaners before booking the right cleaner for you. The best part is their Forever Clean membership, which saves you $30 an hour on all future cleanings. Book unlimited cleanings starting at $19 an hour, backed by HomoGlow's happiness guarantee. HomoGlow services are only available in the U.S. Take home cleaning off your plate this fall by using HomoGlow. Head to homoglow.com/obscura to get your first 3-hour cleaning for only $19. That's HomeAglow.com/obscura.
1967, at age 28, Robert and his wife decided to leave the Midwest behind them. When Darla graduated from college with her master's degree in education, the couple moved about as far away from Minnesota as you can get without leaving the country. They decided that their new home was going to be in Alaska, which only 8 years previously had been admitted as the 49th state of the U.S. 2.3 times the size of the state of Texas, Alaska is the largest U.S. state by an area bigger than France, Germany, and Britain combined. But in 1967, it only had the population of 278,000 people, making it the most sparsely populated of the 50 states. The vast terrain of Alaska consists of 160 million acres of unspoiled wilderness, 6,600 miles of sweeping ocean coast to the north, west, and south, large rivers, 100,000 glaciers, national parks, over 3 million lakes, rainforests, active volcanoes, and an abundance of wildlife. Of the 20 highest mountains in the United States, 17 are found in Alaska. The Kinnick River Valley is located only 25 miles outside Anchorage, near the Chugach Mountains, but may as well be a world away. The valley is a popular spot for hunters looking for mountain goats, doll sheep, black bears, wolves, moose, and migratory birds. The 40-kilometer river itself runs from the Kinnick Glacier, flowing northwest until it empties close to the mouth of the Matanuska River. But despite its spectacular natural beauty, it's not unusual for inexperienced hikers and hunters to get lost in Alaska's mountainous and remote expanse. The hazards can be deceiving. Robert found work in Anchorage as a baker and a warehouseman, where his co-workers noticed that he liked to brag about stealing and how much he loved hunting. Robert worked hard, though, and was initially the primary breadwinner for Darla and their two children, managing to save enough to eventually purchase a home and two cars. When Darla returned to work, she tutored children with learning disabilities from the nearby elementary school. Robert got along with his neighbors, and he and his wife became active in the local Lutheran church. Following his father's death, Robert inherited a collection of firearms, including revolvers and 17 hunting rifles. Robert continued to hunt with gusto, by now a skilled marksman who proudly displayed his hunting trophies in the form of mounted animal heads and hides on the walls of his den. Robert had become so experienced that from 1969 through 1971, he had 4 titles entered into the world record books of hunting. He set records in 1971 for killing caribou and bighorn doll sheep with a bow and arrow, along with other records for hunting mountain goats and black bears. On November 11, 1971, 18-year-old real estate secretary Susan Heppard was driving home to her Anchorage apartment when she pulled up at some traffic lights on Northern Lights Boulevard. As another car pulled up beside her, she reflexively turned to look at the male driver, and they exchanged a brief smile. When Susan arrived home, she was surprised to find that the man had followed her. The man asked Susan for a date, as he didn't know many people in town. But Susan declined and thought that that was the end of it. 10 days later, Susan arrived home to her apartment when the same man confronted her at her door. He held a gun to her head, threatening, "Shut up, sweetheart, or I'll blow your head off." Susan ignored this threat and screamed for her life, prompting the man to run from the scene. Susan's roommates immediately called the police to report the terrifying ordeal. When the man was located by police nearby, they quickly identified him as 32-year-old Robert Hansen and found a .22-caliber pistol under the driver's seat of his car. Robert denied assaulting Susan, telling police it seemed like a bad dream, but he was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. After Robert was charged, a court-ordered psychiatric report stated that he suffered from a mental illness in the form of bipolar affective disorder, accompanied by memory loss and thought disorder. suggesting that this is what caused him to engage in criminal activity. 18-year-old student Celia Van Zanten lived in Anchorage with her three older brothers and cousin Greg Nicholas in a large house on Kinnick Avenue in South Anchorage, near Northern Lights Boulevard. Known as Beth, she attended Anchorage Community College and was close with her family, who were members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. On the afternoon of December 22, 1971, Beth, who was looking forward to Christmas, went shopping with her mother, aunt, and cousin. When Beth arrived home later that day, she watched a movie with two of her three older brothers. Around 8:30 p.m., Beth decided that she wanted some soda. As there was none in the house, she decided to head to a nearby Bilo convenience store, only a few blocks away. Before she left, she told her brothers that she was supposed to babysit for one of their cousin Greg's friends. Beth told her brothers that if Greg arrived to pick her up while she was out, for them to have him wait until she returned. Beth didn't have much time to get to the store, which she knew closed at 9 p.m. She was seen walking to the Bilo between 8:45 to 9 p.m. A neighbor also claimed to have seen her on Northern Lights Boulevard at this time, but Beth never made it to Bilo. When she didn't return, her brothers assumed that their cousin Greg picked Beth up on the way to the store and taken her to her babysitting appointment. As a result, Beth's brother didn't report her missing until 2 days later. Beth's body was discovered on Christmas Day, 1971, by two brothers visiting McHugh State Park south of Anchorage, who were taking photos of the winter scenery. One of the brothers saw what he thought was a mannequin partially buried in the snow and laying at an odd angle. It was Beth's body, naked from the waist down. Her jeans, green parka, and rubber-soled hiking boots were all missing, but found near her body were pieces of yellow tissue paper. Beth's bra had been slashed with a knife and her hands bound behind her back with speaker wire. There was also a gag on her face. In the days following her disappearance, temperatures in the state park ranged from a low of negative 5 degrees Fahrenheit to a high of 22 degrees Fahrenheit. Handcuffed and faced with the impossible climb up a steep slope, Beth was unable to fight the effects of exposure and had frozen to death. It appeared that Beth had temporarily managed to escape from her assailant. However, the snow was 3 feet deep and she fell 50 feet from where her killer's car had been. In the nearby parking lot, investigators found circular tire marks on the asphalt, indicating that Beth's attacker had been tearing through the area, searching for her before he left. A search of the surrounding area later revealed a silver belt buckle and a black leather belt. At Beth's autopsy the following day, it was confirmed that she had been sexually assaulted and had also sustained a diagonal slash mark between her breasts. Aside from the wire used to tie Beth's hands, there was little forensic evidence. No hair belonging to anyone else was found on Beth or her clothing. The semen found in her vagina couldn't be tested for DNA at the time. Forensic scientists could only match blood samples, not DNA. Beth's exact time of death was unclear due to low temperatures that had frozen her body. State troopers had difficulty identifying the source of the wire restraint. It was a double-strand, black and white stereo wire, with indications it was made in Japan. Troopers contacted local businesses and Interpol in an effort to track down the manufacturer and identify an American outlet for the product. In terms of gathering witness evidence, troopers scoured the greater Anchorage area, interviewing Beth's friends and acquaintances. No one knew much at all. Beth's ex-boyfriends were also interviewed, but this too proved a dead end, as their alibis all checked out. But within a week of Beth's disappearance, troopers found two witnesses who'd reportedly seen her in the bathroom of the Value Mart at around 3:30 or 4 p.m. on the day she went missing. While in a bathroom stall, one witness heard someone say, "Get up off the floor, Beth." When the witness exited the stall, she saw a girl with long, wet, blonde hair sitting on the floor of the bathroom. She was wearing dungarees, but had no shoes or stockings, and her green coat was lying on the floor beside her. Her bare feet were purple from the cold, and she was smoking a cigarette. The witness asked her what was the matter. Beth told the woman her feet were cold, but she didn't have any shoes. So the witness asked Beth if she wanted to contact the store manager. Beth declined the offer and said she had walked a long way, telling the woman she had to walk to Bilo and meet someone in the parking lot. While Beth was answering the woman's questions, the woman noticed Beth kept looking at the wall, suggesting she didn't want to engage in the conversation. One friend described Beth as an extrovert who didn't scare easily and who liked to walk everywhere, even by herself at night, but that she wouldn't accept rides from strangers. Other friends told police that Beth was shy and reserved, and also that she didn't trust her cousin, Greg, who lived in the house with Beth and her brothers, and whose bedroom was next to Beth's. This gave police cause to look at Greg more closely. Beth and Greg were said to have conflict in their relationship, and while it was suspected that Greg may have been sexually attracted to Beth, it was never proven. Greg told police he had been out drinking heavily with friends the night his cousin disappeared. Towards the end of the night out, Greg and his friends were stopped by APD, who made the group take a cab home due to their state of drunkenness. Greg certainly had the opportunity to kill Beth, but to complicate matters, he later claimed he spoke to Beth at the house that evening. However, her brothers claimed they didn't see Greg at the house at all. Greg eventually took a polygraph test and passed. Some witnesses, meanwhile, reported seeing Beth hitchhiking as late as 11 p.m. the night she disappeared. But an unexpected break in the case came within 24 hours. 18-year-old sex worker Sandra Patterson came forward to report that 3 days before Beth went missing, Sandra was kidnapped by a man she had an appointment to meet at the Nevada club. Sandra was addicted to heroin and used sex work to fund her dependency. Sandra told police that when she met the man in the parking lot of the club, he kidnapped her at gunpoint and threatened to kill her if she didn't do what he wanted, telling her he was a fine, upstanding businessman in the local community. The man bound Sandra's hands together with shoelaces and proceeded to drive her south along the Seward Highway. He kept pulling his car off the road, trying to kiss Sandra and telling her he wanted to have sex with her, but she refused. The man forced Sandra to take off her clothes and said he wanted to slash her bra with his knife. He then told her he was going to take her to Kenai to some cabins. The pair eventually arrived at the Sunrise Inn on the Kenai Peninsula, 2 hours' drive south of Anchorage. The man raped Sandra, but he failed to orgasm. They then left the motel, and the man drove into the Alaskan wilderness. Getting further away from any nearby towns, Sandra managed to convince her captor to turn back, but on the way back to Anchorage, the man threatened to kill Sandra if she reported him to the police. Sandra later told the APD that the man's penis was shaped funny, like it was deformed or something. It was short, but very large around. Sandra described the man as aged between 23 to 28 years old, around 5'8 or 5'9, with a slim build and short blonde hair, who was wearing horn-rimmed glasses. He was also wearing a jacket, GI-type pants, and dark heavy boots. Sandra was shown a picture of 32-year-old Robert Hansen, which police had taken following his arrest for his attack on Susan Heppard the month before. When Robert kidnapped Sandra, he was still awaiting trial for the November assault on Susan. Sandra told police, "You know, I may be doing something that some people don't think is totally acceptable. And it may not be, but that's not why I'm here. I'm here because that Hansen guy is probably a premeditated, cold-blooded killer who has killed before. He said he killed before, and everything he said was absolutely true. Every threat he made, I believed. And if he says he's killed people, I believe he's killed people. If you've got a young girl who's been killed around the same time and in the same area, then I believe it was Hansen who killed her. I believe he'd kill me too." Police impounded Robert's car, and on the 29th of December, brought him in for questioning with both the APD and Alaska State Troopers. During Robert's interview, which was punctuated by numerous long pauses while he collected his thoughts, Robert was notably evasive and repeatedly claimed to remember nothing when questioned. Robert admitted that check-in documentation from the Sunrise Inn the morning after Sandra was kidnapped looked like his writing, but couldn't say whether he had written it. When he was asked if he had anything in his wallet that bore his handwriting, he produced a piece of paper with the name J. Patterson and an Anchorage address. Robert claimed he didn't know what the note was, who it related to, or how it even came into his possession. Police asked him about meeting Sandra at the Nevada club the morning of December 19th, but he denied going to the club. or driving his car on the day in question. However, the evidence against Robert was strong, and he was charged with kidnapping and raping Sandra Patterson and assault with a deadly weapon. Bail was set at $50,000. Following the charges, Robert received a psychiatric evaluation, where it was noted that not only did he have a mental illness which would be difficult to treat, but that he had also been fantasizing about harming women since his adolescence. Robert denied any involvement in Beth's murder. He stated that on December 22, 1971, he went to work at 4:45 a.m. and headed home after finishing at 2 p.m. He spent the rest of the afternoon and evening with his family, going to bed at 11 p.m. He claimed that the following day, he got up at 4:30 a.m., arrived at work at 4:45 a.m., again working until 2 p.m. It didn't go unnoticed that in his handwritten statement, Robert made 9 references to the time of day. He did admit to usually carrying a .22 Colt Woodsman handgun in his car when he went out hunting, but eventually decided he didn't want to continue the police interview without speaking to his attorney. While Robert denied being involved in Beth's abduction, police arrived at the conclusion that based on Robert's account of his movements on December 22nd, it was certainly possible for him to have kidnapped and raped Beth and abandoned her outside to die. The similarities between Beth's kidnapping and Sandra's experience showed that both girls were taken to the same area, had their hands bound, were stripped to prevent escape, had their bras slashed or threatened to be, and they were sexually assaulted. Beth's house was also within a mile of the apartment where Robert had accosted Susan Heppard. In March 1972, Robert went to trial for his assault on Susan Heppard. In agreeing to a no-contest plea, the subsequent charges regarding Sandra Patterson were dropped. At trial, Robert's minister testified on his behalf, portraying him as a hard-working Christian family man and upstanding citizen who worked 2 jobs. His employer testified he was a capable and willing worker, and a psychiatrist asserted that the offense resulted from Robert's diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Despite Robert's previous psychiatric assessment identifying a desire to harm women, the judge concurred with the psychiatrist, sentencing Robert to 5 years imprisonment on the condition that he continue to receive psychotherapy. But in June 1972, after serving only 6 months, Robert was transferred to a halfway house and placed on a work release program where he was considered to be a model resident. While it was initially suggested in 1971 that it would be difficult to treat Robert's bipolar disorder successfully, a subsequent letter from a different psychiatrist some months later indicated that Robert had made such an improvement through therapy that he was suitable to be released on parole. After all, he had a trade, a family, was a churchgoer, and had an interest in the outdoors, particularly bow hunting and fishing. November 1972, Robert returned home to his family.